Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on our program, I'll talk to the Special Investigations Unit as it uncovers 2 billion rands worth of corruption at the Tembisa Hospital here in Gauteng. Cape Town CBD crime is down 35%, the city says, but doubts do remain about real safety. Consumer confidence dips in Q3, but people keep spending, and why insurance is vital for small businesses in South Africa's so-called trust economy. It's Tuesday, the 30th of September. Now, you'll be well aware the Special Investigating Unit has unveiled a sprawling corruption scheme at Tembisa Hospital, accusing crime syndicates of looting more than 2 billion rand and bypassing every oversight trigger in place. It's an enormous scandal, and it implicates powerful networks, internal collusion, and systemic failure of procurement safeguards. With criminal referrals underway and civil litigation in motion, the stakes are high. I want to give you more details now. I'm in conversation with the SIU's Kaiser Khanyaho. Kaiser, let's start with this. If syndicates bypassed every trigger alert, as I've mentioned, how serious, in the SIU's opinion, is the failure inside the hospital and, for that matter, the health department?
It is very serious in the sense that we have found that the processes or the protections are there. The problem is there was a lot of collusion between the officials and the syndicates. Therefore, that's where the issue is, because we do not blame the policies and the safeguards. It's more the fact that all of those things were done, but they were done in an irregular manner because there was collusion. The officials, for example, would go and say the things were delivered and write that in a book when things were not delivered. Therefore, those were the problems.
Fraudsters, if I've read this correctly, kept tenders under 500,000 rand to dodge oversight. One's got to ask the question, who allowed this and how can that process be approved?
Yeah, that process is part of an allowed process. But the issue here is each and every transaction that is below 500,000, you don't take that to a tender. You then have to do three codes, which is allowed. But the problem then here is they then pitted, the three codes were then sourced from the same people. Therefore, they will get the three codes from different shelf companies that they've bought and then compete against themselves. Therefore, ultimately, they will be the winner either way. Therefore, they then work around the system to make sure that they do that. They then split the amounts so that they don't go above 500,000, and then they do many transactions that ultimately led to the 2 billion we're talking about.
You've named three big syndicates, one tied to a specific family, contracts worth hundreds of millions of rand. Are you able to tell us at this point what proof links them directly to those deals?
Yeah, the three syndicates that we have named, basically the syndicates are nine. But the six are very small syndicates, and then the big ones are the ones that we mentioned as Maumela, Mazibuke, and X. Therefore, each one of them has got companies, about 217 companies collectively, linked to them. Therefore, we were able to see all these transactions, and we found that there was either sharing of directorships of the companies that are within this syndicate, and we're able to link the transfer of money from each and every one of them to the main owner of the syndicate. And all of that was done when we were following the money.
Why are you not naming the X in terms of the syndicate identification?
We are not naming X syndicate because there are still legal processes that are going on with him. Therefore, we do not want to be taken on litigation against us on these matters. But once we are done with those legal issues, the same way as we are not naming the officials, except to say this, the officials are on level this and level that for that same reason.
You've referred, if I've read this correctly, 4 matters to the NPA and 25 to the South African Health Professionals Association. You've launched civil cases worth just over 53 million rand. That would seem small compared to the 2 billion rand said to be involved.
No, definitely. Because the issue here is we can only take those that are ready. As we have indicated, this is an interim report. We are still going on with the investigation. Therefore, the number of people and companies that will be referred to NPA will increase, and then the number of issues that are taken to the tribunal will increase. As you might have heard yesterday, when we were at the press conference, we were given an indication that we just got a freezing order from the tribunal of over 500 million.
You say that juniors often signed off under orders. I guess the key question there is you've got to make sure that their bosses are investigated and the juniors are not simply scapegoated.
Yeah, in this particular instance, and that's why we made it very clear, it was not necessarily the seniors that did anything. We could clearly follow this matter to these juniors, and we were able to even see the transaction that they were paid, because they collectively received an amount of 122 million, with one of them in their bank account having been transferred an amount of 30 million rand. Therefore, that is an indication that corruption doesn't necessarily only happen at the higher levels. It also happens at the lower levels. We have also seen a similar situation when we're doing an investigation with the refugee center in the Home Affairs, where people stay in lower position. They don't want promotions because they make money from where they are sitting. But we are also looking at whether why there was no checks and balances. When the amounts were going up, where were the managers throughout the chain? Why were they not saying anything?
But it's critical that the public has got to be assured that suspects are not going to escape justice because of technicalities, weak evidence or court delays. How much concern is there in that respect?
We don't have that concern because we are taking our matters to the tribunal for recovery. Therefore, we are aware that there are other processes that happen in the NPA, and we hope that that doesn't happen, obviously, because we give them the evidence that we have. The NPA already has worked with us to freeze the properties of Maumela, and they've used the evidence that we gave to them. Therefore, we are comfortable that this will continue.
And just finally, the murder of whistleblower Babita Deokaran does hang over this case. Can you protect future whistleblowers from violence and intimidation? Again, that is a concern.
It's a very serious concern, and that is why it was also raised by Advocate Mutibi in the press conference, to say that in as much as it's a very costly exercise, we have put aside money to protect the whistleblowers. And we are comfortable that that will happen, and we will try everything in our power to do that.
Kaiser Khanyahu speaks for the Special Investigating Unit. Thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, consumer confidence in South Africa has slipped again, down 3 points in the third quarter of 2025, according to Momentum's Investments latest Consumer Pulse report. Now, if I understand this correctly, the middle class is feeling the squeeze, even as high-income households cushion spending. Household consumption, which drives over 60% of our GDP, remains resilient, but there are cracks showing. And the report forecasts just 1.7% growth in household consumption next year and a modest 1% for the overall economy. So the festive season spending is ahead, and there are persistent questions about jobs, about service delivery and costs. So what does all of this mean for growth, stability and policy? Let me try and pull all of that together. And joining us is Momentum Investments Chief Economist Sanisha Bakiresamy. Sanisha, a very warm welcome to you. So let's make sense of this. Confidence is slipping among middle income earners. That tells us something, does it not, about the health of our economy? What is it?
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Jeremy. Yes, indeed, it does explain to us that the recent rebound that we've been seeing in consumer spending has more or less been led by your lower and your upper segment, with your middle income consumers really feeling the squeeze. And I'd say that your middle income consumers have been feeling the pinch for quite some time, especially from a tax perspective. So whenever bracket creep comes in, it tends to hit your middle income consumer the most. Why? Because your lower income tends to be sheltered by things like social grants. And we've seen that the year-on-year increase in social grants has still been reasonably healthy. And if you look towards the top end, we know that the wealthier consumers in South Africa tend to have a bit of a buffer in terms of savings and other areas where they can get a bit more money, such as credit if needed, in order to supplement their spending in times of hardship.
Sanisha, for the purposes of our conversation, what defines a middle income earner?
Well, we've defined it based on the F&B Bureau of Economic Research methodology, which they use for their consumer sentiment survey. And they basically take that the middle income household is one that typically earns between 5,000 Rand and 20,000 Rand per month.
If high income households are, as you're suggesting, propping up spending, it also begs the question about how sustainable over the short to medium term the support actually is.
Well, if we look at your top end consumer, typically, you know, they tend to feel a little bit wealthier when gains in the stock market go up and when housing prices increase. And so that we've seen quite a strong performance in the South African equity market. Those that are exposed to global markets have also experienced some uplift there. And if we look at the housing price index, and especially the one that comes from Statistics South Africa, in real terms, we've seen that this house price index has gone up in the last four consecutive months. So starting to come out of that slump, and I think that has really contributed to your upper end feeling a little bit wealthier. Now, we know in general, the savings rate for households in South Africa is quite poor, but it tends to be a bit higher for those on your upper end. So I think that could carry us through. And if we look at, you know, the cost of living crisis that consumers in general face since the pandemic days, we've actually started to come out of that. And that's because your real wages have started to improve. And I think this is really the bright spot for South Africans, is that inflation is actually less of a worry here than it is in a number of other areas in the global economy. I mean, just testament to that, if you look at the Ipsos survey for September, and they look at issues that can particularly trouble the survey respondents, the one measuring inflation, you know, South Africa is quite low on that list at 23rd out of 30 countries. And again, you know, we actually rank a bit better than the global average here. So we've seen that inflation is much less of a problem in the South African context. And that, of course, boosts your real purchasing power at the end of the day, the real money that sits in your pocket after taxes are taken out and after that inflation impact comes out.
Sanisha, let me pick you up on that household consumption forecast. 1.7%, I think I said. Does that point to resilience or stagnation?
I think we're seeing a little bit of an uptick coming through from the consumer. You know, given that the consumer is about 60% of the overall economy, if we can get the consumer chugging along, we can get economic growth chugging along again. And if we look at the numbers again, you know, the real wage growth impact is going to benefit consumers, even though credit is quite muted. We think that that gain will essentially come through in the purchasing power improvement, or your improvement in the disposable income. And for the last couple of years post the pandemic, we've seen that consumers have been in quite a slump because of that cost of living crisis. But as inflation has come down, those real wage gains have started to pick up, and we think that that's going to go into your household spending, and that's essentially what's going to drive economic growth this year.
But the problem is the economy only expected to grow at 1%, which effectively puts us in a low growth trap.
You know, South Africa has been struggling with the low growth trap, I would say, probably since the global financial crisis. And I think a very big component of that has been because fixed investment spending has been lagging. And, you know, when we talk about the makeup of economic growth in South Africa, what really drives sustainable growth is fixed investment spending, because it tends to have quite a high multiplier on economic activity. When growth is supported primarily by the consumer, you do run the risk that a lot of that can be credit driven, and it's not the healthiest type of growth for economic activity. Now, if you look at fixed investment spend, since the global financial crisis, in real terms, the average growth rate here has actually been negative. And the number one reason is because policy uncertainty has been very elevated in the current political context in South Africa. So going into 2026, 2027, we hope to see that the structural reforms that are being undertaken by Operation Vulindlela and certain government departments in areas of energy, logistics, and water can start to propel those fixed investment gains once again to create a more sustainable outlook for economic activity. But unfortunately, for the interim, we don't think that there's enough certainty that's being created on the political side in order for us to see a near-term recovery in fixed investment.
And that is a critical point, because if government fails to deliver on those levers that you mentioned, it is going to result surely in a contraction of consumer behavior next year.
You know, on the consumer front, quite a lot will depend on what actually happens to the inflation outlook. So whether inflation continues to remain quite modest, of course, that then takes away from your nominal wage growth. And also, you know, in terms of what the outlook looks like in terms of the political discourse in South Africa. So we know that consumers are also negatively impacted by policy uncertainty to a degree. They tend to lay off on their big ticket items when periods of uncertainty creep up. So, you know, trying to reduce that overall political uncertainty in the current climate in South Africa is not only good for your fixed investment prospects, but as you say, it's also would improve your outlook for the consumer. Mm.
You did, and this is just, I'll need a quick answer here. You did talk about a more benign inflation environment, but it also goes without saying, surely, that households remain exposed if inflation turns upwards again or if we get another interest rate shock.
100%. So if we look at our inflation forecast, we are expecting inflation to remain quite modest. If we look at the drivers, services inflation remains largely intact. Food inflation has actually surprised us in the latest print, coming in a bit lower than expected. The rand has actually been reasonably stable despite the ongoing geopolitical uncertainty in the global landscape and the policy uncertainty here domestically. And those tend to be, you know, your larger drivers of the inflation outlook. Even with the tensions that we've seen in the Middle East and continued tensions between Russia and Ukraine, we've seen a bit of a lid on oil prices, and so that actually has capped the fuel inflation in South Africa. In fact, we think that the improvement in the inflation outlook could actually lead to further interest rate cuts, maybe not this year, as we've seen that the South African Reserve Bank has maintained a level of caution, but we think that that could be in the offing in 2026.
Sanisha Pakirisamy, thank you very much indeed, Chief Economist at Momentum Investments.
MoneyWeb at midday. Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
Now, crime in the Cape Town CBD has reportedly dropped, with incidents down 35% year on year between January and mid-September, according to new data just released by the Cape Town Central City Improvement District. Credit card fraud, general theft, and cell phone theft have all shown steep declines, but the same report highlights a sharp rise in drug possession cases and drinking and driving incidents. So let's discuss these numbers and what they mean for safety in the city centre. I'm joined now by Yuri Burever, who's head of safety and security at the CCID. Yuri, a very warm welcome. A 35% drop in incidents does sound impressive, but how confident are you that this reflects reality and not just underreporting?
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you for the opportunity. Jeremy, I'm relatively confident that it reflects what is reported to our 24-hour control room. I mean, we've done this analysis since I've started here in 2023, and I can tell you that we get so many reports on a daily basis, but not only on the crime, but every single incident, because everybody knows our number. So I just want to stress that we cannot compare this with the SAPS reported stats. This is only reported to our control. So I don't think it's underreporting. I think it's on the dot.
Drug possession cases, though, have skyrocketed. I read more than 400%. That is worrying. Surely it suggests that crime in that particular area that you look after and watch is rather mutating rather than just falling.
Well, let me explain to you what's happening with the drug-related incidents. People understand where our borders are, and they tend to sell the drugs outside our borders, but then move over into our areas. with the help of the city CCTV monitoring teams, they tend to pick up these transactions. And as soon as these people move into our area, we apprehend them. And that has been the contributing factor to the high increase in this drug-related incidents and arrests.
A similar problem is drinking and driving incidents, which, Yuri, I see have more than doubled. How do you guys claim success when such a dangerous category is rising so sharply?
Well, Jeremy, what has happened was we've identified the issues because of all the motor vehicle incidents and accidents happening, especially at night in the CBD. And we pinpoint it to being drug-related. So as a CCID, we have no authority to actually apprehend people drinking and driving. So we had to rely on the city to come to our assistance. And I mean, if you can look at the figures, since they came to the assistance, you've seen this huge increase in drinking and driving incidents and subsequent arrests with these drinking and driving incidents. So it's actually a positive for us because I think it will scare people off from continuing doing this. And I mean, this is an ongoing process that we're going to follow throughout the year, and especially the festive season coming up as well.
You cite joint operations with the SAPS, and that's all well and good, but I'm wondering if this is really a case of your organization, the CCID, doing the work that the SAPS surely should be doing in the first place.
Well, we've always been a top-up service for them. But I mean, we know the issues that the SAPS have with manpower and such. But I mean, we are committed to make the CBD a safe and secure place for all. So we took it on ourselves to make use of our own law enforcement contracted officers to do our normal operations, but then to build the relationships with SAPS and see where they can help us, as well as with the other law enforcement agencies from the city. And I mean, in this integrated approach, I think we can make a huge impact.
Yuri, I want to come to that figure of 66%. General theft is down by that percentage. I'm wondering how believable that is in a CBD that to many people still feels unsafe.
Well, unsafe in certain areas in the CBD, it's true. But in the majority of the areas in our four precincts that we cover, I don't think people feel unsafe at all. Because, I mean, we do quarterly surveys at every single stakeholder and businesses in the CBD. And I mean, they give positive feedback in terms of how they feel about safety and security. They normally complain about homeless and vagrancy and begging, but relatively, I think 88, 90% of the people feel relatively safe. But I must stress, there are certain areas which are not as safe as we would like.
Of the crimes that you're currently dealing with, which is the one to the CCID is of most concern, and what kind of urgent action, in your opinion, is necessary to bring it under control?
Well, I think the one that makes the most damage to the reputation of the CBD, and especially with the amount of tourists coming in there, is the card scamming incidents that we... I mean, although we see a decrease in it, it's not stopping. And it's just moving outside of our borders. But these guys are very persistent, and they keep on coming back. So that one, for me, is the number one that we need to do. The second one that people need to do is, we have a lot of theft out of motor vehicles, but it's because of people leaving valuables inside their cars. They forget to lock their doors. They leave their windows open, and they just... on the excursions, and when they come back, they see their stuff is gone. And that's why we've implemented a tremendous effort in our Stroll Smart and Stay Sharp awareness campaigns, where we go on the streets and we talk to people, and we give these pamphlets out to the hotels and Airbnbs, and we stress. This year, we actually moved the card scamming to the number one on the pamphlet, because it was always number four, because we realized that people read the first page and not all the pages.
Yeah, I think that's probably true in most things in life. Yuri Brevet, thank you very much indeed. Head of Safety and Security at the Cape Town Central City Improvement District.
MoneyWeb at midday. Business news. You're listening to MoneyWeb at midday.
This interview is brought to you by Old Mutual Insure. Protect what built you.
Now, I don't need to reference the fact that South Africa's small and medium businesses are always under pressure, from load shedding that we've seen in the past and late payments to theft, unrest, rising costs. In what's been called the trust economy, reputation is as important as revenue. Customers and suppliers want reliability, but one disruption can undo years of goodwill. So how do SMEs protect what they've built, and what role do brokers and insurance play in making sure those businesses can keep their promises? I'm in conversation now with Sean van den Berg, who is executive for Alternative Channel Solutions at Old Mutual Insure. Sean, a very warm welcome to you. I'm interested in this concept called the trust economy. Give me a little bit more flesh on the bones as far as that's concerned, and maybe more importantly, what does it mean in practice for small businesses?
Thank you, Jeremy. So see it as trust is a commodity that's traded in an industry. If you're a broker, your brand, your reputation hangs on every single action that you do. If you fail a client, you fail a business during a process of a claim, or losing something, or there's a catastrophe event, and that reputation affects you as a broker, but also the SME. So when a client is failed, or you don't come through for a client because of a delivery or something happens, that trust is broken between the client, the consumer, and the SME. And clients are not necessarily worried about why your truck didn't arrive, why you couldn't deliver on what you promised. They just see you as a person who failed them at the time of their requirement or their need. And that's the trust economy. If you lose your reputation, you lose your business.
What you're also suggesting, if I understand this, is that it's almost a form these days of business capital. It would be on par with money in the bank or even assets.
100%. So these days, if you don't have trust, you've got nothing to trade. People look at referrals, go on the internet, look at reviews. They ask a friend for referrals when they approach a medium enterprise. So if you've got a good reputation, odds are you're going to get returning business. You're going to get more business from the consumers and the customers that you deal with. But if you don't, you know, you're likely your business is going to fail.
So, Sean, let's look at the relationship now between trust and the insurance industry in particular. And how can one uninsured incident damage not just a balance sheet, but also, as you've suggested, reputation?
So I alluded to it earlier, but simple things like a vehicle caught in an accident with someone's goods being delivered, or a supplier of yours needing to produce a critical ingredient to something that you need to produce, not delivering on time because of an unfortunate accident or event, creates a chain of events that ultimately falls back to the consumer. And as I said, as a consumer-facing business, if your reputation is built on delivering on time and delivering quality goods, you can damage your business critically at that moment.
So the problem, I guess, that you've got to overcome in your particular sector is that many small businesses see insurance as a grudge purchase. In order to maintain that trust, and I guess almost build it at the get-go, is that you've got to shift perception. How do you do that?
So I think it's education first. So any business has a lawyer, has an accountant. I think any business should consider insurance as a partner and not a grudge purchase. You should partner with someone who looks at your business, identifies critical assets, critical processes that will weaken you or bring you to your knees if something were to happen. You cannot live without that. And at the time of that incident, like you need a lawyer when there's an issue, or your accountant when you need to look at the books, you're going to need a good insurance cover and a good person to give you advice at that current time. Look at it as a partnership. When you start small, when you still business, start with a broker who can look at your business as they grow and look at the critical things. It doesn't mean you have to insure everything, but look at the things that would be critical to your business, because it might just save you over the long run.
And it's critical in that respect, Sean, that brokers themselves tailor cover to the day-to-day realities of small businesses. Again, you've alluded to that, but with the understanding or with the appreciation that those day-to-day realities can change all the time.
100%. So as SMEs goes through their phases from growth to expansion to dips, you know, businesses go through dips, insurance brokers have multiple data points which they've dealt with over the years. They identify businesses in their cycles, and they're the best position to be able to tell you where there's critical, I guess, factors that you need to look at. But also, not just that, risk management is such an important part of insurance. It doesn't mean you have to transfer your risk completely to the insurance company, but there's critical risk management factors that you can look at a business that can help you prevent any unfortunate events. And brokers are trained over the years to be able to identify those risks and help you to just overcome it or at least mitigate it.
So, Sean, just a final question then. Your big theme is protect what built you. If you could give SMEs one piece of advice about safeguarding trust in that build process, what would it be?
So I think there's three things, right? You need to make sure you partner with a broker who understands SMEs, understands your business, takes the time to learn your business, that can tailor the solution for you. But the second thing is also partner with an insurance company that's got a good track record, a company that's been there for a while, low rejection ratio, good service. That will assist you when something happens to get back on your feet. And then thirdly, look at a company that's looking for technology enhancements. You know, with the world moving forward in technology, you need to make sure you're at the forefront of any sort of technology to assist your business to get service quicker, but also just to help you mitigate some of the risks that you do face. And hopefully over the long run, these technology advancements can just help the SME run their business smoother.
Some very valuable advice there. Sean Vandenberg, thank you very much indeed. Executive for Alternative Channel Solutions at Old Mutual Insure.
This interview is brought to you by Old Mutual Insure. Protect what built you.
So you thought you were building a business in this economy, but day by day, somehow it grew. You kept going when the freezer didn't freeze, the bucket didn't budge, and the bank balance barely blinked. So you thought you were building a business. You weren't. It was building you. Because this isn't just what you do anymore. It's who you are. And you don't trust just anybody to protect it. Chat to your broker about Old Mutual Insure Business Insurance. Protect what built you. Old Mutual Insure Limited is a licensed FSP and non-life insurer.
And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.